Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session. Pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court are posted outside and in the clerk's office and are available for your inspection. There are three causes that will be submitted by oral argument this morning. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Railroad Commission of Texas and Bill Forney Incorporated versus Ponderay Oil and Gas Company Incorporated and others from the 13th District, Live Oak County. Fort Bend County Drainage District of Fort Bend County versus Benny Sprutz from the 14th District, Fort Bend County. And Eugene Perez versus Briarcroft Service Corporation from the 13th District in Victoria County. All three of these causes will be submitted before we break for lunch, but we will have a brief recess in between the presentation of each. Counsel in the second and third causes do not have to remain in the courtroom, but we ask that you remain nearby so that we may proceed to your matter at the appointed time without delay. All counsel are notified that we are recording these arguments for the convenience of the court. Should you desire to listen to a tape of these arguments, you may make application with the clerk of our court. In the first cause, Railroad Commission versus Ponderay, we have allotted 30 minutes for the petitioner and the respondents to present oral argument. The court is now ready to hear from petitioners.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Seibert and Mr. David Nelson will present arguments for petitioners. Mr. David Nelson will open. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is David Nelson. I'm appearing here today on behalf of Bill Forney, Inc., a petitioner in this proceeding. Mr. Forney was an applicant before the Texas Railroad Commission in 1984, seeking relief under the Mineral Interest Pooling Act. He filed an application with the Railroad Commission seeking authority to utilize that act in forced pooling acreage, which he leased in Live Oak County, into an existing producing gas unit that was operated by Ponderay Oil and Gas in what was designated by the Railroad Commission as the Limes Field. The Railroad Commission conducted a hearing in the spring of that year to consider that application. And in May of that year, shortly following the conclusion of that hearing, the Commission issued an interim order pooling a portion, the productive portion of the Forney acreage, into the existing Bennett unit. The application for writ of error before you was granted on petitioner's points 1, 2, and 3. The first point deals with the utilization of this interim order, and that's the point that I would like to discuss initially. The use of interim orders by the Railroad Commission is a recent development. In an effort to protect the interests of those parties who have acreage that is being confiscated or being drained, the Mineral Interest Pooling Act is designed to allow that acreage to participate in existing units, so the owners of the minerals under that acreage will receive proceeds from that production. And in Railroad Commission proceedings, when a hearing is held before the Railroad Commission to consider this application, in many instances, because of the administrative process and some of the delays that are involved in that process, it often was 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 months or more from the time the initial hearing was held until a final order could be entered. If during that interim period the evidence showed that the minerals under the applicant's tract were being drained and confiscated, he simply received no compensation during that interim period. So the Railroad Commission, in its wisdom, in an effort to try to rectify that situation, adopted a procedure whereby if it appeared that the application on its face initially had some merit, it would adopt an interim order. And that's what happened in this case. We have put on the easel here a diagram, which Mr. Moody and I will both refer to, and Mr. Seibert, but just so you will understand, the area outlined in white is the existing Bennett Tanqueray gas unit. The area outlined in orange is the acreage owned by Mr. Corning, and the green line represents a determination by the Railroad Commission of the productive limits of the field. Now, what the Railroad Commission was telling the parties when it issued this interim order in May of 1984 was generally this. They said, look, we think on the basis of this application, there is evidence to believe that the Forney Track, a portion of the Forney Track, is productive in this reservoir. That would be the portion of the Forney Track north of the Green Line. We also believe that the Bennett well, operated by Ponderay, has drained and is draining the hydrocarbons from beneath that acreage. And in order to protect the interest owners under the Forney Track, we think it is appropriate to issue an interim order. The interim order will provide for Forney's participation in the unit during the interim period. The interim order is included in the appendix to our brief, and it provides and puts Ponderay on notice of this fact that they should escrow a certain amount of money attributable to the Forney acreage during this interim period. So I think you can see that for many reasons, and specifically for the protection of correlative rights and to provide for compensation when confiscation is occurring, the use of the interim order is very important. Another important aspect of this interim order is that it put the parties on notice of what the Commission intended to do. Now, one of the problems with an interim order is that the Commission, at the time the interim order was issued, had not made a complete and total factual determination about the exact number of acres that are productive within the Forney Track and within the Bennett Unit. Interestingly enough, in this case, concurrent with this application, there was pending before the Railroad Commission a review of the entire Limes Field, which is outlined in green. The Railroad Commission was considering at the same time a determination of the entire productive acreage for that reservoir, which would include not only the Forney Track and the Bennett Unit, but all of the acreage in the field. The parties to the pooling proceeding agreed that the record in that proceeding should remain open until the Commission made a final decision with respect to the exact productive acreage. So the interim order was simply an effort to come to a preliminary determination as to what appeared to be productive. And in the interim order, the Commission said it looks like the Forney has about 35 productive acres. It looks like the Bennett unit is approximately 290 acres. So we're going to presume we've got about a 325-acre unit, of which Forney has 35 acres, or about 11%. In September of 1985, 1 year and 4 months after the issuance of the interim order, the Railroad Commission issued a final order in the field-wide hearing, the hearing that determined the productive limits of the entire field. That is also included in the appendix to our brief. And in that order, the Commission did two things. One, the Commission decided that for purposes of allocating production in this field and for purposes of determining the equitable shares, that they would go from a two-factor formula or two-dimensional formula, which was productive surface acres, to a volumetric formula, which would include the thickness of the reservoir under each track, so that they added a third dimension. They said it's more equitable to determine not only the productive surface acres, but we will determine the thickness of the reservoir under each track in feet and multiply that by the number of acres, and you come up with what's referred to as acre feet. In the appendix to the brief, where the order is contained, it specifies in great detail the number of acre feet to be allocated to every track in the field, not just the Bennett unit, not just the Forney track, but to every track, and it specifically states the amount. That was entered in September of 1985, and that's where the problem arises. Ponderay contends that at the time that order was entered, they suddenly were not operating under the same interim order. They said, well, Commission, you've changed the rules. You've changed the method of determining the allowable. You've gone to a new formula. We are perplexed. We don't know what to do. We're in a quandary. We're mystified. We were supposed to escrow a certain amount of money based on productive acres. Now you've gone to acre feet. And we're not really sure what we're supposed to do here.
Counsel, what was it about the interim order which saved the retroactive order of the Railroad Commission from being an unconstitutional order?
Your Honor, there are two cases that are cited frequently on the unconstitutionality of retroactive orders. The American Trading case and Butte Resources. Both of those cases were decided in 1987. Neither of those cases contained interim orders, and we believe they are clearly distinguishable for that reason. In both of those cases, the Railroad Commission merely entered a final order in a Coulin case and elected to backdate it to a previous date without there being any interim order.
So what is there about the interim order in this case that saves the final order of the Railroad Commission from being unconstitutional?
Your Honor, I believe there are two major issues. One, the Court of Appeals in the Butte Resources case and in the American Trading case, and the Court of Appeals in this case, have confused allowables with vested property rights. They, in the Butte Resources case and in the American Trading case, they alleged that there was a violation of the vested property rights by making the orders retroactive. When you have an interim order, one thing that that accomplishes is it puts people on notice as to what you are going to do, so that they are aware of what the allocation is going to be. Secondly, there is no authority in Texas to suggest that allowables are vested property rights. To the effect that, or to the extent that the final order changed the method by which allowables are determined, that is a given. Allowables are adjusted each month based on the amount of acreage assigned or acre feet, the capacity of the well to produce, the pipeline's demand for gas. There are many factors that go into allowables. But the Gillespie case and others have held for years that allowables are not vested property rights. So the fact that an order is issued which affects allowables or takes away allowables does not in any way affect vested property rights. So we're not talking about vested property rights here. We're talking about changing the method by which the allowables are prepared, and I think that's the major distinction. When Ponderay was concerned about this interim order, and they suggested that somehow they couldn't figure out what to escrow and how much to escrow, and they changed the formulas, it's all a smoke screen. Gentlemen, I have a...
Was that suggested to the Railroad Commission?
At no time did Ponderay ever object to the interim order, and at no time was there ever any effort made to change that.
After the field determination order issue, was there any effort made to request the Railroad Commission to clarify its prior interim pooling order?
Your Honor, there was not, and I suggest to you there was no reason to. As I was about to state, in determining what should have been escrowed, in trying to compute that, I have a 10-year-old daughter who's in the fifth grade at Cassis Elementary School here in Austin, and she is of reasonable intelligence, although math is not her main forte. I can promise you that given the factors that are contained in the final order, in asking one to compute the volume of a container, and then asking her to compute the volumes of two containers and putting those together, she could easily tell you what one is as a percentage of the whole. And that's really what's required here. The Commission simply went from a two-factor formula to a three-factor formula. The information in the final order was meticulously detailed in order to explain what the participation would be of the Forney tracts, 375 acre-feet, the Bennett unit, 5,378 acre-feet. So the method was clearly available to show what Forney's participation would be. Now, Ponderay could have easily made that calculation, and there's nothing in this record to suggest that it was so whimsical or mystifiable that they couldn't do that. The fact that the commission changed the method of allocating allowables does not in any way affect the ownership. The ownership in the unit and the participation in the unit is based on how much Forney's tract is as to the whole. But the factors in determining the allowable are an entirely separate issue. Allowables are not property rights. The allowables change every month. Some months they go up, some months they go down. They're based on a lot of different factors. And I think what's happened here is that the appeals court has confused allowables with property rights. And that's a fundamental flaw. The fact that the method for computing the allowables changed should not in any way affect Forney's participation in the unit. We're trying to determine the size of the percentage or the piece of the pie that Forney gets. We're not trying to determine the size of the pie because that may change periodically. But what we're trying to do is establish what his percentage participation will be every month, whether the well produces 10 cubic feet of gas or 10 million cubic feet of gas. He's going to get a certain percentage every month, and that shouldn't change.
Are you saying the only thing that the final order changed when compared to the interim order was the allowable?
What it did, yes, Your Honor.
It changed the
allowable and the method by which those allowables were computed. Instead of the allowable being, it said nothing about the pooling order. That was in a separate docket. In fact, the interim order in the pooling matter said that this order will remain in place until superseded by another order in this docket. The final order did nothing with respect to pooling. It talked about the method by which the allowables were computed. Now, when the Railroad Commission issued a final order in the pooling case in August of 1987, that proceeding was it decided to pool the acreage, taking into consideration the thickness. So the percentage that Forney received, it just so happens, was reduced from what he had originally because taking into consideration thickness, his percentage participation was less. And what the commission decided to do when they pooled is they said, okay, if you're going to allocate production on the basis of thickness, we'll use that for basis of pooling too.
Your light flashed about 3 minutes ago. Is that a signal to that means something?
I'm sorry.
Between you and counsel for the other party.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Seibert. I'm an assistant attorney general for the railroad state of Texas, representing the Railroad Commission of Texas in this cause. I would like to point out initially that there are really two main issues in this case that are really important to the jurisprudence of the state of Texas as well as the Railroad Commission. That is the effective date of a pooling order, which Mr. Nelson has been talking about, and the procedure that the Railroad Commission used to pool the main and the stray sands. In this case, the Railroad Commission strongly contends that the Court of Appeals judgment and result frustrates the purposes of the MIPA. In this case, it discourages voluntary pooling. It results in the drilling of unnecessary wells. It would not protect the correlative rights of the applicant in this case. And furthermore, it would probably produce waste.
The Railroad Commission's powers in that regard are derived from what the legislature gives them.
That is correct.
And the legislature hasn't given the Railroad Commission the authority under the heading of regulation to do what they did in this case.
Well, I think they have. And in the Mineral Interest Pooling Act, the Commission has powers to pool together units if certain conditions exist, and the statutory authority is set out in 102.011. But in general, overbroad considerations, the Railroad Commission has very broad powers to regulate the natural gas production in the state of Texas. They have very broad discretion to do that. It's under Chapter 86, which is natural gas regulation. And that has to be kind of grafted on top of this because that's what we're talking about is natural gas production here. And in this case, in the issue of the effective date of a pooling order, the commission devised an interim order that put everybody on notice as to what was happening. And that included the opponents to the pooling order. Pondere knew what happened with this case. And if you look at their final statements, In their closing statement to the commission, which is in footnote 11 of the Railroad Commission's brief at pages 26 and 27, it's obvious that they knew what the interim order was going to do, and to that approach they had no objection.
And without the Rule 10 exception permitting downhole commingling, the Railroad Commission could not have pooled the two strands, the two sands, could it?
We feel that the Railroad Commission had the jurisdiction to do that. From the
even
point,
without the downhole commingling?
The downhole commingling has been happening since the field was drilled. And
without the downhole commingling?
No.
Would the Railroad Commission have had the authority to pool the main and stray sands?
Probably not. Because, in fact, the production would probably have been considered illegal production at that time if they had not done the downhole commingling. In other words, they would have had to then split out one of the sands as an entirely separate field. But what actually happened was, for the entire history of this field, from the time of first production until to this day today, both sands are regulated as a common reservoir. At a point in time when people became aware that the geology may be different, those facts came to light, and the Railroad Commission made a determination that the two sands were not in natural communication, and you cannot produce from the same wellbore two different stratas. And that's where you have to have the Rule 10 commingling.
Why isn't it true that the Railroad Commission has increased its authority to pool by simply granting a Rule 10 exception for downhole commingling?
I don't think that it has increased its authority to pool. The commission looked at the facts of this case. At the time that the application was filed, Mr. Fournet had to make an application to pool the entire field. That's what he made the application for. And the field at the time was a common reservoir containing the main sand and the stray sand.
But it wouldn't have been but for the Rule 10 exception.
Well, yes, that came in later on. In other words, if the commission had decided this case before that field rule's final order came out, this case wouldn't be here today. This other case was going along parallel. They made a determination and said, we're going to have to commingle this back because we want to, one was to prevent waste, and they didn't think that they would probably lose both stratas if, in fact, they tried to separate them out. And
now, what you're saying, the Rule 10 exception made this a common reservoir?
Yes, by definition.
What about the Grayford Oil case that defines common reservoir?
Those are not MIPA cases. In fact, one of the things this court has to do, the MIPA does not define common reservoir. And
well, the Supreme Court did in 1977 in the Grayford Oil case. It requires natural communication.
The commission would contend
that
that's
no longer an applicable definition.
For purposes of the MIPA, we would suggest to the court that with the fact of this case being so unique, the Rule 10 commingling was not a part of the Grayford case. And when you take the factor of you have a common reservoir, it instantaneously, the geology's been this way for probably millions of years. We can't change that, although that can change. But what happens by definition with the Rule 10 commingling is that the for purposes of Rule 10, it says that anything that's commingled pursuant to Rule 10A of this will be considered as coming from a common source of supply. And because you have to look elsewhere for definitions of what a common reservoir would be, the term common source of supply means common reservoir, and that's under Chapter 85. And the Commission believes that it had the jurisdiction to pool both sands.
But not only that, the Commission, using its Rule 10 power, can make a common reservoir where there is none other one.
That would be correct, yes. It would be almost like...
Even though it wasn't a common reservoir before the Rule 10 exception was enough, the Railroad Commission, by its order, can transform it into one.
Yes, that is correct. And in fact, it was we regulated it as a common reservoir between 1981 and 1985. And in fact, everybody thought it was a common reservoir. A point that I would like to point out is that Ponderay, in its response, has never complained about this interim order, and they say on page 17 of their reply brief, Ponderay was not then and is not now aggrieved by the interim order. And we find that to be very strongly in favor of what we're dealing with on that retroactivity point.
Councilman, getting back to the pooling authority of the commission, what do you propose we do with the Bishop Petroleum case, which addressed this and held this similar issue or same issue and said that the pooling authority of the Railroad Commission was not expanded by the commingling statute?
The Railroad Commission's position on Bishop Petroleum is, one, that the case is an extreme example of what happens when a court tries to decide a case and writes a lot of dicta on something that wasn't necessary to decide. If they wrote 27 pages of dicta and then at the end of the opinion said, well, gee, because the appellant has not, or the opponent to pooling hasn't preserved error at the Railroad Commission, we can't decide these points. But of course, they had written so much ahead of time. And in doing so, they interpreted the statute much too strictly. And we don't think that that was called for in the case. We think that the approach used by the Supreme Court in the Rio Grande Valley case to interpret the term field is a very reasonable construction. And I think that the Bishop, the Waco court in the Bishop case was a very unreasonable interpretation of the commission's statutory authority.
Is this court's resolution of the conflicting standards of judicial review that apply to Railroad Commission orders a significant issue in this case?
Yes. In fact, I would like to point out that this has been a horrible problem for the Attorney General's office over the last 6 years since the Carson case came down, where it said that a fair and reasonable offer would not be reviewed by substantial evidence but is a jurisdictional review. And since that point in time, every single person who has opposed pooling and lost has come up to the district court and tried to persuade the district court, the Court of Appeals, and so on, that the standard review is not substantial evidence. But the issue of a fair and reasonable offer is a fact question. The Railroad Commission has to look at the facts and make that determination. And how could it be any other type of review but substantial evidence? And
I would say the court have to overrule Carson?
I don't believe it would have to overrule Carson, but I think it would have to point out that that language in Carson was not what was intended. I would think that you could perhaps call the issue of a fair and reasonable offer a threshold type issue, that if there isn't one, then the Railroad Commission didn't have statutory authority to pool under 102.011. But I think it's fairly clear that the issue has to be decided on substantial evidence. There's no other way to do it. Otherwise, it would render the, if you were to say it was a preponderance of the evidence review, beyond a reasonable doubt, what quantum of evidence and type of review is a jurisdictional review? We don't know. I liken it to a phantom review because it doesn't exist in the jurisprudence of the state that I know of.
It has to have ramifications for standard judicial review for other agency decisions.
That I don't know, because the fair and reasonable offer issue is a very unique offer, unique issue to MIPA cases. And MIPA cases don't come along all that often, but almost every one of them that has come along has managed to get its way to the Supreme Court. And I think that they're always very complicated and difficult cases to decide. But yes, it could in other areas that would have similar type of threshold issues.
Any other questions? All right. Well, since we took your rebuttal time, we'll give it back. 5 minutes for rebuttal. The court is now ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Dan Moody, Jr. will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Moody, Jr., and I'm here to represent Ponderay, the respondent, with respect to certain points. We're also an applicant with respect to one point of one application for writ of error. I would like to try to reply to the various things that were stated by counsel that have preceded me, but I'd like to correct one thing. Mr. Nelson, in his general statement of what this case was about was, I think, accurate, except in one regard. He described the interim order as being an order that pooled the track. That is not the case, gentlemen. The pooling takes place, if it does, only when the commission has finished with all making all the findings that are required under the MIPA. The interim order is reproduced in the, I'll use the reference to the Railroad Commission's brief. They very kindly provided the court with an appendix that includes just about all the documents, or one of the main documents, and I believe Appendix C to that brief, or to that application, is the interim order. And it's clear in reading that order that what it did was, it said, and I understand that the interim order was entered in order to give the commission a foundation for a possible retroactive order or some kind of an action to protect from the delay that occurs inevitably in the administrative process. But what they did was they said, we are going to give the Bennett Well some extra allowable, some extra acreage from which allowable is calculated and from which, of course, production flows, and we're going to require that that be put into escrow. That's all it did, to lay the first beginning foundations for some kind of a dealing with the retroactivity situation. Now, as I see it, the issue on retroactivity is, can the Railroad Commission deal with the problems caused by the sometimes lengthy hearings by a retroactive order, and if so, what must the commission do to support such an order? The courts of this state have said that retroactive orders are not cannot easily mount the hurdle of the constitutional prohibition against interference with vested rights. Now, what we're talking about in vested rights here is not a right to an allowable. We recognize that the allowable can be changed by the commission at any time. The basis for the allowable can be changed at any time. What we're talking about is the vested right that occurs when production occurs under an allowable. An allowable results in the wells being assigned certain rights to produce. They then produce that if they can. And that the money that results from that production is divided and maybe spent by the party. It is that production, which has already occurred, we were talking about as the vested right. Counsel for the other side has continually said that we're trying to claim a vested right in allowable. We are not doing that.
Your view is that by you're entitled to the increased the production from the increased allowance that the Railroad Commission allows.
No, sir, Your Honor. We've escrowed that. We're not saying that we're entitled to that unless it's determined that there's no pooling or something of that sort. It was produced from our well. We recognize that the interim order put some money in escrow, but it seems to us that what the Commission must have done, must do, in order to justify a retroactive order. And it may be that they can't ever go over this hurdle, but to do that, they must follow it up by a determination that what they have done by the interim order has provided protection. They must inquire into what the result of what this interim order was. What was escrow? How does that match with what they're now telling us we've got to pay to people that were not in our unit at the time this production occurred? Because there was no pooling, I think it's clear that there's no pooling occurred until the order was entered in August of 1987, I believe. And that the commission didn't do. Your Honor, the last evidentiary hearing in this case was June the 20th, 1974. And that's true, the record remained open, and it was thought that there was going to be a further evidentiary hearing. And later on, the record was supplemented by bringing in various documents, including the one on the board there, from the what we call the field hearing, the other hearing. But the parties agreed that it was not necessary, or the commission ruled, and the parties didn't dissent from it, that it was not necessary to have any further evidentiary hearing because by supplementation of the record, that was all that was necessary. That didn't have anything to do with this interim order. Therefore, the commission never heard one word of evidence about what the effect of the interim order was or how this escrow fund related to what we were being asked to pay. Now, with the retroactive order, if it's made retroactive, we're required to pay to these people a portion of the proceeds of production that we received during the time when they were not in the unit, with no finding by the commission that bears any relationship to what was in the escrow fund. That's not in evidence. There's not one word of evidence about what's in the escrow fund. We're saying that to justify a retroactive order, the commission must not only enter the order, that's not the magic word, interim order doesn't say the constitutional prohibition has gone away. What they've got to do is then proceed at the hearing to make a determination that the interim order has avoided
the constitutional problem with a retroactive order. That they did not do.
And that would happen if the amount escrowed exceeded the amount due the person who was added to the pool.
Your Honor, I think that's probably right. I suppose it could be somewhat more complicated than that to make sure who got it and how it all sorted out, but I think in a general sense what Your Honor said is correct.
But if your position is if that escrow does not
certainly
meet or exceed what is due the new pooled acreage, that it would have unconstitutional retroactive effect.
Yes, sir. And because not of any right to allowable, but because of a right to the production that has already occurred and been divided and distributed, except for the escrow fund, among the owners of the Bennett unit. That's our position. And
in your brief, you claim that the retroactive pooling affects private enforceable contracts that any of the interests were operating under prior to the order. Is there some factual basis in the record you can point us to as far as private enforceable contracts that were affected by this retroactive order?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that there was no discussion of that. I guess I can't say that the commission took that up, but I think the court can take and the commission can take judicial notice of the fact that parties have interest in the unit. They know that the Bennett unit is a unit in which that particular Forney acreage has no interest. Mr. Forney may have an interest in the unit from some other right, but from the acreage question here, he has no rights to it. That property is owned by other people, and the production from that is going to be result in being sold and be divided among parties. There are certainly relationships among parties in the unit. I think it's clear that the commission had that before them. The unit was a unit recognized by the commission. There is no point in the record where I can say there was a discussion of those rights to which Your Honor has just referred.
That's a potential problem in retroactive order cases, but you can't point us to any place in the record where that happened in this particular case. Am I understanding you correctly?
I believe you're correct in understanding that I can't point to any place in the record where we proved that there was some interference with rights. We didn't have any hearing after June the 20th, 1984. In this case, any evidentiary hearing. And this argument about the interim, the effect of the field order in September of 1985 on the interim order, Mr. Nelson says that Ponderay was mystified and confused about what to do. We didn't ever feel like we were mystified and confused. We knew exactly what happened. We were no longer getting any allowable resulting, as the interim order said, from additional acreage assigned to this unit. After that period of time, there was no extra allowable coming in. And one of the members of the court, I believe, asked if anybody complained about this. Well, this record has a bunch of peculiarities to it because it was before the commission so long. And one is that the examiners changed quite a bit. And at one point, there was a new examiner assigned. And so to try to get things, we had had some negotiations and things, and it looked like we had to get the hearing moving again. So letters were written by both parties to tell the new examiner kind of what the status of the hearing was, bring him up to date where everything was. And in that letter, Ponderay stated that the interim order is no longer functioning because we're not escrowing any more funds. That was just made as a statement of fact. Everybody, I think, had all the facts before them to know that because they were all involved as operators in the field. They knew what had happened to the allowables, the basis for signing allowables, no longer provided any extra allowable or extra production for which proceeds of which were to be escrowed.
But the commission was never asked to opine on the relationship between the interim order and the field order.
No, sir, they were not asked. But in the response made by Forney to the letter that our side wrote, they said there's no need to give any attention to the interim order at this time. Nobody raised any question about that until it got before the courts. And now the commission says, and through its counsel, and I don't, not through the commission staff, that we should have done something different. But the interim order was not our idea. We were not aggrieved by it, as our brief says. It was fine with us. It was the other side, the commission's idea initially, and there, if it serves any purpose, to enable the other side to have a foundation for getting a retroactive order. It was not our problem to say to the commission, we want another interim order. We were at that time opposing the pooling. We were arguing whether or not they were entitled to do this ab initio, that alone. We were not going to say, well, we need an interim order to so that there can be a retroactive order. And, of course, it's always been a little confused as to just what the commission needs to do. Maybe this court will throw some light on that to have an interim order, have a retroactive order. It seems to me that
in your view, if the escrow amount was equal to or in excess of the amount due to pooled acreage, would this procedure used by the commission, as in this case, avoid unconstitutional retroactive effects?
Your Honor, I think the answer to that question is probably yes. The reason I hedge is only because there may be some other things that an inquiry into the situation would show needed to be attended to and taken care of by an interim order. I think it is clear that the main problem is the money situation, that we don't have to pay somebody money that we didn't have to pay. But I'm not willing to say blanketly and completely that there's no other consideration that would have to be taken into account to avoid a problem with vested rights. I think it's the main one. It seems to us that what happened here was the commission seemed to have thought that by saying interim order, and I admit that we realize that this might be what the commission had in mind. We're not surprised by that, but that the commission somehow feels that having entered an interim order, they have no further responsibility to see what the effect of that was, and may then ignore any constitutional prohibition against the retroactive order. I don't think that's the law. Now, Mr. Seibert, in addressing that, said that in one of our filings, we said we had no objection to a retroactive order. That raises another peculiarity of this case. That folding statement from which he is quoting there was filed by us after the order came out on the Theo Rue hearing and after there had been settlement negotiations. And I'm not straying from the record. This is in the record. But we had settlement negotiations reported to the commission. And at that time, there was a previous proposal for decision, I believe, had come out. And we wanted to get rid of this case. So we filed a pleading saying, if the commission would correct one mathematical calculation error in that proposal for decision, that we would not object to the adoption of that proposal for decision. That was about 4 years ago or 3 years ago. I've forgotten exactly how long. And that is what is in that, that's the statement he quotes from. And we said on that basis, we wouldn't object to the retroactive order disposing of the hearing. But in the same pleading, we said if the commission doesn't see fit to adjust the mathematical thing which we thought was wrong, we continued and preserved our objections to the retroactive order. So it's not fair to say that we have ever told the commission we had no objection to the retroactive order except on the basis of a pleading that said we're trying to dispose of the case. A closing statement, I believe, was styled before the commission. Turning, if I may, gentlemen, to another issue, I think that another important issue is whether the MIPA and the facts of this case justify or authorize the pooling of two separate reservoirs. And we believe that is simply not authorized by the MIPA. And I'm very surprised to find that Mr. Seibert contends that the Railroad Commission somehow derives its pooling authority somewhere else than from the MIPA. That was not the understanding of the bench and bar, I don't believe, when the MIPA was passed. And I think it must be found in the MIPA. Now, certainly the Commission has broad authority to regulate the production and so forth of oil and gas. But I believe it must find in the MIPA its authority for forced pooling, which, as I'm sure the Court knows, in the law prior to that time, pooling simply could not be required. It was against the law of the state of Texas until that statute was passed about, I think, 30 years ago or something like that. And it seems to me that the statute is clear. Now, this Court, fairly recently, I think this summer, handed down an opinion in the Energy Agri, the Amarillo Oil versus Energy Agri Company case, which I'm sure the members of the Court will remember. I don't have the citation. I think it was about the middle of the summer when it was handed down. In that case, the Court considered the meaning of a number of terms in the oil and gas business, particularly applying to producing formations, horizon, stratum, something else, some other things. And those terms, fields, the word field, for example, particularly, is used in a lot of connotations and with different meanings. But there's one term or one phrase that is not used with any ambiguity, and that is the separate or common, the common reservoir, a common reservoir. And the court notes that in the opinion, quotes the statutory deposition, and that's true. There have been lots of confusion about other things, but common reservoir is understood clearly, as I believe one of the members of the court pointed out. This court has stated in previous decisions to mean a naturally separated reservoir, not in communication with anything else. And that is the term that the legislature used in the Mineral Interest Pooling Act in saying what could be pooled. They said a common reservoir.
But by allowing downhole commingling, there is communication between the segments.
Yes, sir, but I believe the definition is clear. The understanding of common reservoir is clear. It must be made by nature, not by man. Therefore, the fact that they allow commingling not only does not make it a common reservoir, but the basis for commingling is that you have two separate reservoirs, which the commission, under its power, has decided may be produced together. The fact of commingling is not in derogation of the separate reservoir nature, but is it complements it.
Well, why is it practically any different whether the communication occurs by nature or by the drilling of what?
Well, Your Honor, obviously there are lots of differences there, I think. That the communication...
With regards to whether the reservoir ought to be pooled or not, what difference does it make whether the communication is natural or because of a man-made wet?
Well, because the communication that's made by man only occurs wherever man has made it. And actually, in this case, the communication...
Is the effect the same?
No, sir, I don't believe so. Because if we have a common reservoir, the theory of that is that all the wells in that reservoir, wherever they may be producing from, are draining the entire reservoir. Now, of course, that doesn't work sometimes if the reservoir is very big, but that's the basic theory.
There's a natural fissure in the strata that allows commingling. Or if there's a perforation due to drilling activities that allows commingling. Isn't it still commingling?
Yes, sir. There could be some mixing of the things, and I suppose if man got busy and did enough, he could blast the strata in such a way that there would be a complete commingling of the two reservoirs. But that doesn't necessarily happen just because there is a communication in a wellbore or in two or three wellbores as there are here. That doesn't mean, for example, that this on this map over here, Your Honor. This red indicates, that's the only thing Mr. Nelson didn't tell you, that's the stray sand, which is only over a part of the reservoir. There are, I believe, eight wells in this field, and if memory serves me, five of them do not encounter the stray. Maybe it's four, but it's five or four of them don't encounter the stray. They don't produce anything from the stray, and they do not necessarily drain the stray. At all, simply because there is a communication created in a wellbore. Now, I'm not saying to Your Honor that it may not be possible for man to break down the communication to such an extent that you only have a single source of supply. I'm saying that the mere fact that there is communication in wellbores and that the production is commingled by the order of the commission in wellbores does not obliterate the fact that you have two separate reservoirs.
How accurately can the degree of commingling be calculated?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. Is this basically,
you know, what the commission's charged with doing in a situation like this?
I didn't quite understand you, Your Honor.
Wouldn't this be what the commission would be charged with doing? Or if it's impossible calculation, don't you have to make certain presumptions?
I think that's what happens. You do make certain presumptions, and I think the engineers could probably
tell. How closely can they calculate a natural commingling as opposed to a man-made commingling, a man-caused commingling?
Well, Your Honor, obviously, in all cases, we're forced to try to decide what's happening thousands of feet under the ground.
My point is, would they have to engage in the same presumptions in either case?
Well, Your Honor,
do they presume the contrary in one case than the other? I mean, are we trying to create a legal fiction here and say if it's done by man, it doesn't exist?
Well, if we are, I'll try to address that, but if we are, it's because the legislature has told us that that's what we should do in saying that a common reservoir has to be in natural communication, and the court has upheld that. Now, it may be that I think that we do have to, sometimes we have to guess a little bit as to what's under the earth, because we just got a limited amount of information coming up from the well bores or seismic data or something. And I don't doubt that there are situations where the commission is wrong about whether it's a common reservoir or not. In fact, in this case, as has been pointed out, originally they thought it was. Evidence came in to say that it wasn't, more, as more wells were drilled, and the commission corrected that and said, no, we were wrong. There's two reservoirs here, not one. And I'm sure they make mistakes, and I'm certain that there are many times when they can't tell and what the situation is, and they do have to make some presumptions and assumptions. But I'm also frequently amazed by how much information they do obtain and how accurate some of the statements, some of the estimates can be as to what's going on under the ground. But I don't think we're creating legal fiction by recognizing that there is a difference between reservoirs which are created by nature separately and are separate accumulations.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying if it can't be determined, a degree of accuracy, whether it's man-made or natural, what the extent of the commingling is, shouldn't presumptions be the same in either case?
You mean the presumption then that that all wells are draining the entire reservoir?
Is that the presumption that's made in a natural commingling situation?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't believe it is all at all that. And the rule on commingling, which is, again, produced as H in the appendix to the Railroad Commission brief, ends up by saying, Mr. Seibert quoted part of that, that once they allow commingling, it will be considered production from common source of supply for purposes of proration and allocation. That's all it says. It doesn't say for pooling purposes. And I think that there is a good argument, Your Honor, that maybe the better law would be to say if we're going to let the commission commingle separate reservoirs and then pool them together. I think that is not an unreasonable position for the legislature to take. But I think the legislature hasn't taken that position, and neither has the Railroad Commission until it came to this. And in fact, in the first PFD for this case, the examiner dismissed this thing in one or two sentences by saying, you cannot pool separate reservoirs, we're not to consider that. It was a one sentence, or maybe it was two sentences, short paragraph. Then later on, for reasons that I certainly don't know, the commission changed its mind and decided, yeah, we're going to do it. But I believe this is the case, this is the first case that they have urged that. They've not in their rules. And I certainly do not argue that it would be an unreasonable thing for the legislature to say, we're going to take into account the very things Your Honor has said and say if there is sufficient man-made communication or something else, and by the way, commingling sometimes occurs when there's not man-made communication, just because that's the most efficient way to produce the reservoirs. And in fact, here, it's not really based on man-made communication. It's based on the fact that the wells have already been completed in both reservoirs and that there's only a few feet, I think about 8, separating these two reservoirs, and it would be exceedingly difficult. This was the evidence that was presented in the case to justify commingling. It would be exceedingly difficult to separate the production from the two reservoirs in the existing wells. So the commission said, okay, we're going to let them be commingled. But it might be very logical to say that the commission should have the power to determine that if reservoirs should be commingled, they also should pool. Our point here is the legislature has not given that authority, and the authority must derive from the MIPA, and they can't do it, and we do not think the legislature, the court, should clothe the commission with this authority in the face of what the statute says. The
statute allows the commission to regulate once commingling has been allowed. Why doesn't that allow pooling?
I think the reason for that is that the regulation of production and the regulation and that sort of thing is for the purpose of regulating how much is produced and all that sort of thing, but it has never been understood, I don't believe, Your Honor, as encompassing a pooling authority. The pooling authority must be built on the MIPA, and the MIPA says that you pool a common reservoir, and over in another section, I believe section 18, I may be wrong about the number, it says that you must determine how much productive acres there are in each, pool only productive acreage in the reservoir.
But neither the Pooling Act nor the statute relating to commingling make the Pooling Act exclusive
neither those two statutes per se make the Pooling Act exclusive authority for pooling.
I don't think, well, I'm not sure either statute says that. I think that historically the cases have said, and the cases that I believe some of them are cited in some of the briefs, have said that no pooling authority existed, no forced pooling authority, it all had to be voluntary, prior to the time of the enactment of the Mineral Interest Pooling Act. And I believe it's a fair inference from that that the Pooling Act is the sole source of the Railroad Commission's authority for forced pooling. I don't believe the statute says in some sentence this is the only authority for pooling.
Wouldn't it serve the purposes expressed by the legislature in enacting the MIPA to treat a treat this situation as a common reservoir once a Rule 10 exception has been granted by the commission? That is, cut down on preclude the necessity of having to drill additional wells, avoid waste, protect correlative rights.
Your Honor, that might be one way of doing it, but I believe Mr. Seibert is also wrong in saying that that what we propose here would necessarily involve any of that. It's possible to prove the strait. An application could have been filed for that. Also, could have been filed to run parallel with this. And I point out to you, Your Honor, also one thing I don't want this court to overlook. I said that in trying to state this issue, I said it was whether the statute authorized it or the facts of this case authorized it. In this case, the question came up what to do about the stray at both of the two hearings we had in 1984. And in both of those hearings, when we started to talk about what we're going to do about the stray, the counsel for Forney stated in the record, we are not trying to pool the stray in this proceeding if it is a separate reservoir. Now, at that time, the issue of separate reservoir was being considered in the field hearing. Forney was presenting evidence to show that it was separate. And in fact, it was Forney's evidence and Forney's map that was adopted that determined it was separate. Forney's counsel said both times it came up in the hearing, we are not trying to pool the stray in this proceedings if it's a separate reservoir. The citations are in the brief as to the points where that is. Therefore, there was no further inquiry into the situation and problems that might arise there. But I suggest to you, Your Honor, that he could have filed an application saying we want to also pool the stray. Now, I admit that's more cumbersome, and I certainly understand, but it might be more efficient in some cases to pool the separate sands together in one unit, and that might be a better legislative approach to the situation. But in other cases, it might not be so good. In this case, it looks good because Forney's tract is entirely underlain by the stray sand. And the Bennett tract, except for a little corner, is also. So it looks pretty good to pool both of them together. But you could have a different situation, perhaps not in this field, because I don't know whether there's any acres outside, but there could be some acreage somewhere that wasn't drained, wasn't underlain by the stray, that sought to pool with the well that was in the stray, or vice versa, a tract that had the stray that sought to pool with the well that wasn't producing from the stray. And various problems could arise from that sort of thing. So it's not necessarily clear that it's yes, to pool these things together. But I don't believe that there is a necessary loss or waste or something, some correlative rights that can't be protected by the concept of pooling only a single common reservoir at a time.
Does the MIPA define common reservoir? I can't recall.
No, sir. I don't believe that the MIPA defines it. It's defined in another statute which is cited in both y'all's Energy Agri case and
not
in the Bishop case.
It's not defined in the pooling statute itself?
No, sir, it's not. But I believe it is a term that both cases and the law will show has had a long recognized and unambiguous meaning, unlike terms like field and strata and so forth. And that's part of what this court talked about in the Energy Agri, Amarillo Oil versus Energy Agri case, and also, I believe, in some other cases.
When was the MIPA first enacted?
Your Honor, I don't know. I think it was about 1961 or 2 or 3 or somewhere in there. I really don't know. I suppose I've got a copy of it. It probably shows on here.
I don't want you to take your time.
Well, we can find it. I think it was 1965, Your Honor, but I may have to stand corrected on that. I think my time is about to expire. I would like to say one other thing, that we do not believe that, that this court needs to do anything about the Carson case, in which it says that these reviews of the fair and reasonable offer situation are jurisdictional reviews. I think they clearly are that. And as the court knows, I don't have time to argue the point in any detail, but we have the third important point in this case is the question of whether the facts of the case authorize pooling. Whether it's a fair and reasonable offer has been made. And I think the Carson case is right. I do not think there needs to be any change in that. But I believe in the facts of this case, there simply are no facts to be determined. The offer is there. The court can determine as a matter of law whether it was fair and reasonable. The argument we think shows that it was not. Thank you for your time. We appreciate
counsel,
being here.
Counsel, let me ask you a question with regard to the judicial standard of judicial review. Why should this court or any court undertake a de novo review of the facts for a Railroad Commission hearing to determine whether or not the Railroad Commission was actually correct in our view, as opposed to granting at least some deference to the expertise and experience that that agency has in specialized matters such as these under substantial evidence review?
I'm not here telling you that you should. I do not think you should. But I think that the cases have held that the determination of whether an offer is fair and reasonable is a matter of law, is a question of law, not of fact. If there were issues of fact as to what was said, what was done, something like that, those issues should be decided by the Railroad Commission, and should be, those fact issues, I think, probably should be reviewed by the court on a substantial evidence basis. I don't think the Carson case says anything about that not being the law. I think what it says is that the question of fair and reasonable, as some other case, I believe it's the Windsor Gas case, if I remember it cited in the brief, has said, the ultimate question of fair and reasonable offer is a legal issue, which this court and any other court can pass on as well as the commission. But if there are disputed facts, I believe, Your Honor, that the review procedure we have here in Texas would result in the fact findings being made by the commission, which it didn't do in this case with respect to they're inadequate. We've got that point in our brief. It don't come close to showing the facts. But that those things, if the commission has found such and such a fact, I think the review of that should be under the substantial evidence rule, just as Your Honor suggests. But the determination of whether the jurisdictional requirement of a fair and reasonable offer has been met is a question of law, which I think the court can consider on a different basis from the substantial evidence. And I think that's all the Carson case is saying. And I believe it's fairly interpreted that way. So we're not trying to say in this case that by holding that the offer, a fair and reasonable offer, it's a matter of law. There's not any dispute of facts. The facts are there's one offer, one letter. You can read it, see what it says. We're not talking about a bunch of fact issues that we want this court to redetermine. We think this court should look at the facts that are undisputed and say this to what the statute obviously meant to be a meaningful requirement, not reduce it to simply a letter that says we want to negotiate with you guys about approving it. It's got to be an offer that we could, not necessarily would, but could accept to create a contract. And it's got to be fair and reasonable.
So the Supreme Court of Texas will ultimately determine whether forced offers to pool are fair and reasonable in any case that may come before the Railroad Commission if the parties have the resources and motivation to bring it here.
Well, perhaps if there's a basis for attacking the commission's determination that it was fair and reasonable, if I think that's right, that other points of law you have to decide also, not necessarily the Supreme Court because you have a ability to turn down cases, but let's say an appellate court.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, I believe I have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and two items that I think need some attention. First of all, with respect to the interim order, one item that is important in this case when looking at the facts of the case, when we talk about vested property rights, the impact that the interim order had on Ponderay. In the interim order, it was suggested that a certain amount of money be escrowed, and the computation of that amount as representative of the Forney interest was 11%. The productive portion of the Forney tract in the interim order, 35 acres compared to the whole unit of 325 acres, would have resulted in an escrow of 11% to Forney. When the final Railroad Commission order was entered, pooling, the actual participation that Forney was given was 7.23%. The fact that Forney had to release less than what was originally escrowed cannot be a derivation of any vested property rights. Now, I recognize the fact that if the reverse is the case and you put a certain amount in escrow and then the commission issues an order and says, no, you don't owe that, you owe a lot more, you may be creating some problems. But the facts in this case show that the amount escrowed was in excess of what the final amount was as far as the percentage to Forney.
What about dollar?
Same thing. Second issue. Mr. Moody characterizes comments made by counsel for Forney that we're not pooling the stray sand. Gentlemen, I can't tell you what a gross misstatement that is of the intent of this whole proceeding. What we were alluding to at the commission was when the Railroad Commission was trying to decide what constituted the Limes field, one of the questions was whether it consisted of one sand or two. And we said to the commission in the pooling proceeding, if you find that the stray sand is not part of this field, if you wish to treat it separately and set it up as a separate reservoir with a separate designation and separate rules, then we're not pooling the stray. We will file a separate proceeding for that. But at the same time, if you consider it by commingling it as part of the Limes field, then we most definitely wish to participate in that. You know, you ask what should be done with the Bishop case. I think the Bishop case is just clearly a misstatement of the interpretation of the Mineral Interest Pooling Act, and they got confused in dealing with definitions of reservoirs and what constitutes reservoirs and the effect of commingling. But one fact is very important. In 1981, the legislature amended the Natural Resources Code after the Graper case to specifically provide and to give the Railroad Commission the authority to commingle multiple reservoirs for purposes of preventing waste and protecting correlative rights. When production practices were necessary, the Commission was given that authority.
But if one of the two sands did not underlie the Forney property, he ought not to be in a pool that contains both.
If both sands were not present, Your Honor, then that would not be a factor in the pooling. That's correct. What we have here is we have a situation where both of the sands are present in the productive portion of the Forney tract. Ponderay has completed its Bennett well by perforating both sands. They are producing both of those sands simultaneously.
If that were not the case, then the fact that they were commingled somewhere else at some other location would not entitle Forney to pooling of both sands.
No, you're right, Your Honor. We're only contending that the pooling of both sands occurs where in this particular well, the Bennett well, where the commission has allowed co-mingling of both of those zones. They've allowed Ponderay to produce both of those zones. The production of both of those zones will drain both of those zones under the Forney tract. It flies right in the teeth of the MIPA to say under those circumstances, you can't pool them both. I believe my time is up. Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.